Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, filmed before a live audience in Washington, D.C.,
it's time for Let's Make a Deal!
Behind curtain number one, small business tax credits starting as early as next year. Behind curtain number two, stronger language on abortion. And behind number three, the public option curtain, nothing. Oh, it's empty. No public option. Instead, there are two new national insurance plans managed by the U.S. government. You get all this, plus a tax on tanning beds for the low, low price of $871 billion. So come on down, America. Let's play Let's Make a Deal on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 21st. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is away for the holidays, but I'm here with Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent.
Good morning, Celeste. It's December 21st now. It's the shortest day of the year.
That's right,
it's the solstice. We don't have a lot of time, so let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. It's a milestone victory for Senate Democrats. Just a few hours ago at 1:30 a.m., they cleared the first of three major hurdles by passing a health care overhaul by 60 to 40 vote. There will be two more procedural votes before the Senate votes on the bill itself on Christmas Eve. But even before this morning's vote, President Obama was already confident.
As with any legislation, compromise is part of the process. But I'm pleased that recently added amendments have made this landmark bill even stronger.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell questioned the timing of the vote.
But make no mistake, if the people who wrote this bill were proud of it, they wouldn't be forcing this vote in the dead of night.
For details, we're joined now by Theda Skocpol, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University. Good morning, Theda.
Good morning.
So in this bill, there is not a public option. I don't know what to call it. They have two government-run insurance plans. One of them will be nonprofit. Is anybody referring to this as a public option?
No, it's not the public option that we thought of as something that working-aged Americans or their employers might buy into. Remember, though, we are expanding Medicaid and improving Medicare in this bill.
Well, does having these two insurance companies that are going out on the exchange run by the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, does that accomplish pretty much the same thing that a public option does, or is it completely different?
No, it's a little bit more of a fig leaf. It doesn't create a powerful government-run insurance plan to compete with the major insurance companies. They're not likely to be strong enough to do that.
Okay, Theda Skocpol, stay with us. We're going to talk more about having a fig leaf to cover the naughty bits of health care in just a few moments. But first, overseas in Iran this morning. Tens of thousands of mourners turned a funeral procession for Ayatollah Montazeri into an anti-government protest in the city of Qom. Foreign journalists have been barred, but there are reports of clashes between Iranian security forces and opposition supporters.
The United States transferred a dozen suspected terrorists out of Guantanamo Bay over the weekend. They were sent to Afghanistan and to Yemen and Somalia. The Justice Department says that leaves 198 detainees at the Cuban facility.
Actress Brittany Murphy died at her home in Los Angeles yesterday. The 32-year-old actress starred in Clueless and 8 Mile. Police say the cause of death appears to be natural causes, most likely cardiac arrest. And a public memorial service is scheduled today for TV evangelist Oral Roberts. The service will be held at Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Roberts founded that school in 1963. He died last week at 91.
Asian markets were mixed. European indices are up. Wall Street futures are now up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,328. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ opens at 2211.
We talk about family life every Monday. And what could be more difficult than gathering all your family around the holiday table and having about five or six people argue over what to say during the opening prayers? We're going to talk about how to make family life smooth over the holidays later this hour. And the holiday season is in full swing, but maybe it's not on your street. I'm wondering if you're seeing fewer decorations, fewer lights. What do you see, and how is the economy affecting the holidays on your block? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll talk about winners and losers in the healthcare bill in just a few minutes. Good Good morning, Celeste Headlee. And Todd Zwillick is here with me today. John Hockenberry's away for the holidays. And Todd, you know, we have been reporting on the wheeling and dealing, the backs and forths and arguments over healthcare for months.
Yeah.
This has been the centerpiece of everything that's been going on down in Washington. And it kind of looks like it's winding up, right?
Well, it finally came down to it over the weekend in a blizzard.
Senator, yeah, you had to sit there in the Senate offices.
Trudged up Capitol Hill into the Senate. You know, it was funny. Everyone had suits on the top, boots on the bottom. That's how it worked in the Senate over the weekend.
Well, at least one person is very happy today.
After a nearly century-long struggle, we are on the cusp of making health care reform a reality in the United States of America.
And it's true. Healthcare reform, the idea of it began with Teddy Roosevelt. So it's been a long time coming.
Right. And what they've got now is a glide path to getting this finished, or so it seems.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talked a lot. There was a lot of arguments over the public option. In the end, it's not there.
The public option is not there. This was a political agreement. You just couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate. You know, I think a lot of people knew that from the start, that a public option just wasn't going to survive all of the moderate and conservative Democrats.
So what did we get instead? We have the government-run two companies. One, at least, is nonprofit.
Right. But when you say government-run, not government-run in the sense that Medicare is government-run. These are private plans, but they're administered by the government. So basically, they're private nonprofit plans that have to answer to the government to make sure their premiums don't go too high, they're not paying executives too much, they're not wasting money on advertising, things like that.
And they're going to cover the same number of people that the public option would have covered.
They cover the exact same number, 31 million new people covered under this bill without the public option. The only difference was the public option, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would have done it for about $25 billion less.
Less. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that held us up for so long was Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska wanted stronger language in abortion. And I guess he kind of got it. But in the end, I mean, tell me if you agree with me or not. The language that's in there pretty much doesn't change the standing regulations already in law.
It doesn't change them substantively. Basically, nobody likes this deal. The pro-choice groups on the left and the anti-abortion groups on the right all attacked it at once. The Senate Democratic leadership says that's how you know it's a true compromise, because everybody hates it.
Because everyone hates it. Well, here's Senator Richard Burr.
I could go further on the abortion language. I think the original language that Harry Reid had actually was better than what was negotiated. But you've got to compliment Ben Nelson for playing The Price is Right.
He says he was playing The Price is Right. I'd said let's make a deal, but yeah.
Yeah, and he's basically impugning Senator Nelson's motives, saying that he used abortion as a bargaining chip to get a good deal for Nebraska. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but Nebraska did get a good deal. They got more money for Medicaid. This deal expands Medicaid, but Nebraska is the one state that never has to pay for the expansion itself, ever. It's all paid by the federal government.
Oh, that's good for him. You know, quickly, the Congressional Budget Office weighed in. It's $871 billion, which is more than the previous version of this bill, but in the end, it still saves money on the deficit.
Right.
There's a larger, expanded, I should say, tax credit for small businesses. And here's the odd thing. They took out the language on taxing plastic surgery, but they're taxing tanning beds.
Yeah, the Botox is out. But there's a 10% surtax now on indoor tanning services. They say this is a double good policy. The indoor tanning causes cancer. It's not good for you, so why not discourage it? I think it raises about $2.5 billion over 10 years. Not a great revenue raiser, but it does prove that the plastic surgeons probably have a better lobby than the tanning industry, I think.
Well, we're joined again by Theda Scotchpole. She's a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University. She joins us from her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Theda, let's set the tanning beds aside for just a second, but they managed to get 60 votes. They have two more procedural votes, but what do you think? Is this basically the bill that's going to go before the full Senate on Christmas Eve?
Oh, it absolutely is. I don't think they could change an inch of it if they want to get to 60.
And tell me about this legislation. Do you think it is a good piece of legislation?
It's historic. It's 100 years have gone by as reformers have fought for the principle that government should be involved in access to affordable health care for virtually all Americans, and particularly lower-income Americans. And it's a giant step in that direction.
Are there winners and losers? I mean, they expanded the small business tax credit. It looks actually like that particular piece of it looks like a good thing to me. There's going to be more businesses that are able to get a full credit. Is that to make small businesses a winner here?
Yes, given that we're trying to build on and extend employer-provided insurance for working-aged people and their families. The small businesses are given a lot of help to do that in this bill.
So who are the losers? I mean, beyond the people who use tanning beds regularly, who loses out in this bill?
Well, it puts in place a framework for regulating private insurance companies that they're nervous about. Of course, they're going to get a lot of new customers at the same time. Let's think about this as changing the nature of the politics going forward. It'll be a politics of how we make sure that we afford health care while everybody's in the system. But that's different from the past.
Sadie, there are a lot of middle-class people, union workers with high-cost plans who are going to be paying higher taxes. You could make an argument that that's better for the system, but they're going to feel a hurt, at least in the short term, aren't they?
Well, there were some pretty important exemptions written in, and I think that there'll be some of that. But we'll see. Maybe there'll be some adjustments in where the revenues come from when they do the conference between the House and the Senate versions.
So, you know, Theda, break this down for me as a piece of legislation that affects us both as a government and as a culture. How is this going to affect people's daily lives on their social level? Are we just going to end up having people who are better medically covered? This is going to make a better way of life for Americans?
When it's fully implemented, it's a long time before it's fully implemented, but when it is, we should have at least some degree of assistance through government so that everyone can afford a basic level of health insurance coverage. That makes a huge difference in the security of regular people's lives in America.
Well, you heard President Obama talking about how this bill comes after almost 100 years of struggling for health care reform that began with Teddy Roosevelt's call for this kind of thing. So tell me, if this is historic, and it is also a baby step in that a lot of people feel like this healthcare reform is going to get tinkered with in the years ahead. Is it historic in that any step, even a baby one on healthcare, is a milestone?
This is a big change in the framework, like Social Security was in 1935. It took 25 years for Social Security to grow into what it became, but they started in 35. We'll look back and say we started in 2009 toward affordable, accessible health insurance for all Americans.
Well, there's your takeaway. Healthcare reform began in 2009. Theda Scotchpole, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, thanks so much. It is now 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
Overseas, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says the global climate conference in Copenhagen was hijacked. Prime Minister Brown says the climate summit was held to ransom by a small group of countries and that such a thing must not be allowed to happen again. The climate summit ended with delegates accepting a U.S.-brokered compromise. The Copenhagen Accord gives billions of dollars in climate aid to poor nations, but is not legally binding. In Poland, police say five men detained in connection with the theft of a sign from the entrance to the former Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz acted from financial motives and were not members of a neo-Nazi group. The sign, which reads Arbeit macht frei, work sets you free, has been recovered.
Iran's nuclear negotiator is calling for a worldwide ban on atomic weapons. During a visit to Japan, Saeed Jalali also argued that all countries have a right to develop nuclear energy. He insisted that Iran's nuclear program is for civilian purposes only. The U.S. transferred a dozen suspected terrorists out of Guantanamo Bay over the weekend. They were sent to Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The Justice Department says that leaves 198 detainees at the Cuban facility. Actress Brittany Murphy died at her home in Los Angeles yesterday. The 32-year-old actress starred in Clueless and 8 Mile. Police say the cause of death appears to be natural causes, most likely cardiac arrest. A public memorial service is scheduled for today for TV evangelist Oral Roberts. The service will be held at Oral Roberts University in Oklahoma. Oral Roberts died last week at age 91. And if you're heading to the airport today, expect delays, especially if you're going along the East Coast. They say mostly things are back to normal after the winter storm, though. Those are some of the stories you're following this morning. So who says you have to be ruled by the fine print? Unless you're a newscaster, you probably don't have to. If you've been avoiding the devil in the details, we have lots of good advice for you in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time for the week's first installment of Takeout, stories we want you to keep on top of this week. So around the Takeout table with the Takeout crew, that's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, who does sports, and of course, Louise Story, finance reporter for the New York Times. Hi, guys. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Louise, Citadel Broadcasting, we want to start off with radio company. They own more than 200 AM and FM stations and a lineup of talk shows and talk programming on ABC Radio. Mm-hmm. Newspapers are going bankrupt everywhere, but now radio?
You've been hearing about magazines and newspapers having troubles.
Yeah.
Same advertising slump is hitting radio.
And the same advertisers, I would imagine, in a lot of cases.
A lot of the same companies are pulling back, putting a lot more money online and less in traditional media. And this is the third largest radio company. It has the Don Imus show. And so over the weekend, they decided to declare bankruptcy so that they could get rid of a lot of their debt. They had a huge amount of debt from taking over ABC Radio, which was owned by Disney in 2006.
Right. So they're not going off the air, though. This is more of a restructuring deal.
They'll
stay on the air.
Restructuring. They're trying to find a way to make it work with less debt. And basically, the debt holders, some of the biggest ones were J.P. Morgan and Wilmington Trust, are taking over most of the equity in the company. This is something you're seeing in all kinds of companies. The automakers went through this, for instance.
Right.
And now it's coming to radio.
So it begs the question if there's anything they could have done to avoid this. If it's happened in the newspaper industry, it happened in the auto industry, the smart guys in the broadcasting industry, the commercial broadcast industry, I should say, didn't see it coming.
Well, the question for radio companies is the same question for newspaper magazines, and that is advertising may not make up the same percentage of their revenues going forward. And so is there another source of money that radio companies need to look towards?
Click those websites.
Well, you know, newspapers are looking at making people paying for content online. Do radio companies need to look for something else? Because it doesn't look like advertising is going to come back the way it used to be.
Credit card swipers on your car radio.
Right in your car. That's an idea.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, you know, in public radio, we have a solution for this. We beg. So I guess.
And now we're going to go to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So, Ibrahim, we only have one undefeated team left. The New Orleans Saints went down this weekend.
Romo takes a knee. And the Dallas Cowboys have done something no team has done before this season. They've beaten the New Orleans Saints.
Dallas Cowboys beat the formerly undefeated New Orleans Saints 24-17. Does this mean the Saints are losing their mojo?
That's an interesting perspective. The Saints losing their mojo. The way that the Saints have constructed the season, they were on an incredible tear in the beginning. They were, like, peaking very early. They went on a crazy rise, and then they kind of had a bumpy road. But good to them, they won tough games on that bumpy road.
Yeah.
And then they finally came into an angry, annoyed Dallas Cowboy team that has had a rough December in the past few years, and Dallas thumped them. I think that this exposes some weaknesses in their defense, and I think we'll see going forward if they have enough. I'm not sure. I think they peaked too early, and they might now be on a slide. But this, you know,
we'll see.
Exactly.
You know, it was funny because you have to wonder if the Dallas Cowboys maybe had something to prove, and the New Orleans Saints were like, "Eh, we already proved it."
The Cowboys were definitely fighting for their playoff spot, and they've had really horrible Decembers of late in recent years. So this sort of bolsters up their chances of making the playoffs. It looks like they're definitely going to be in a slot for the playoffs.
So, well, speaking of the playoffs, is it clear now? Do we have a better picture of who's going to be in the playoffs?
In the NFC, there's a much clearer picture. You have all the division leaders are in place. You have the Eagles that are in place. You have the Vikings, the Saints. You have the Arizona Cardinals. They're solid. The teams that are in and out, the Giants might be in, but they probably won't be in because they haven't had the best year as well. And the Green Bay Packers will most likely be in. In the AFC, there's six teams that are 7-7. I mean, and they're all vying for the final playoff slot. So right now, the question in the AFC is who's not in contention for the playoff spot, and you can get more teams in there, like the Bills and the other teams there. So the AFC picture is very complicated. My pick is that I think the Pittsburgh Steelers are going to pull it out. They have more offense than other teams, and they have that championship spirit, and I think they're going
to
pull it out.
And I think they definitely have something to prove at this point. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor, also thanks to Louise Story, New York Times finance reporter.
All right, for our last takeout, we turn it over to you, our listeners. Our series, Life in the Fine Print, is still going strong. We got a lot of responses from a lot of you. That's because when it comes to how the fine print rules our lives, it happens before you're fully aware of what to watch out for. Sometimes you need a college degree to understand the fine print, but unfortunately, it's the fine print that on a student loan, it's sapping you dry. But upcoming college student, here's one piece of advice from 8778MyTake.
This is Jessica in Charleston, South Carolina. I graduated undergrad about 12 years ago, and I worked 3 jobs in college so that I didn't have to take out so many loans. Meanwhile, while I was working all the time, most of the people around me were partying. I think it's about responsibility while you're in college. And I'm sorry, but don't go to such an expensive school. Go to a state school. Work hard. Don't take out too many loans.
But Stephen writes on our website, thetakeaway.org, while I enjoy jumping on the bandwagon and blaming the big bad banks for holding borrowers hostage to their loans, you'd think someone smart enough to get into college could do the math and figure out that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to pay back. I'd like to say I majored in music. Not math, Stephen.
So not easy. Well, he makes it sound simple, Celeste. You say it's not easy. Here's someone who's broken through to the other side of the school loan fine print, and she says all that pain and worry, well, it might be worth it.
My name is Catherine. I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan, and I just paid off my student loan after 20 years, and it was the best investment I ever made. School allows us to have our careers. It's an investment in yourself. You just have to pay it off.
So what's your take? Is the high cost of a higher education worth it in this country, or are cheaper schools the way to go? How much debt is too much to start off with in our adult lives? Let us know. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we give you a preview of what will be making news in the days ahead. It's Monday, and it's time for The Agenda. It's coming up in just a few minutes.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, we have a preview of the news in the days ahead. We check in on The Agenda. That's in just a few minutes. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 31 minutes past the hour. Senate Democrats are one step closer to passing a bill that would overhaul health care. The first vote came in the early morning hours.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 40.
That's the sound of the Senate. It cleared the first of three major procedural hurdles before the full vote on the bill itself, which should be around Christmas Eve. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid convinced two holdouts, Independent Joe Lieberman and Nebraska Democratic Senator Ben Nelson, to move the health care reform measure forward. Nelson is already feeling some heat this morning from abortion rights groups and Republicans in his home state. He's issued a statement defending his vote, saying too many people are struggling to pay for their health care, so that doing nothing was not an option.
Heading overseas, tens of thousands of mourners turned a funeral procession for Iranian Ayatollah Montazeri into an anti-government protest in the city of Qom. Foreign journalists have been barred, but there are reports of clashes between Iranian security forces and opposition supporters. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says military force would only have limited effect in stopping Iran from developing nuclear weapons, but it must remain an option. Admiral Mike Mullen told his staff this morning he believes political means are best at achieving regional security. And earlier this morning,
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Fueling tower separates. Booster ignition. Liftoff.
A Russian rocket carrying an American, Russian, and Japanese crew members took off for the International Space Station. A NASA webcast showed the crew giving a thumbs-up sign as the rocket headed skyward. Also rocketing skyward, shares in Dutch luxury car maker Spyker. The company is trying to rekindle talks with General Motors to make a new bid to buy the Saab brand. And looking at the markets, Wall Street futures are now down. The Dow gets underway at 10,328. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ at 2,211. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Accelerating job growth.
Healthcare costs.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Uranium enrichment.
Taxpayer costs.
Ask ourselves the hard questions.
Okay, it's time to check on the agenda for this week as we head into Christmas time. We've got Chris Hayes, Washington editor for The Nation, joining us, and also Jill McGivering, Asia editor for our partners, the BBC. Chris, I want to start in Washington and on the health care debate. The Senate has cleared its first procedural hurdle, and it looks like this health care deal is headed towards final passage. So on the agenda seems to be dealing with the House, and I just want to have you listen to Senator Ben Nelson. He's the one who struck the deal that got this health care bill to 60 votes, but he's forecasting how this is going to go when it gets to Nancy Pelosi. Listen to Nelson.
Let me be clear. This cloture vote is based on a full understanding that there will be a limited conference between the Senate and House. If there are material changes in that conference report different from this bill that adversely affect the agreement, I reserve the right to vote against the next cloture vote, and I will vote against it if that is the case.
Chris Hayes of The Nation, that sounds like Senate talk for my way or the highway.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of hostage takers in the upper house right now.
Right.
Ben Nelson being one of them. And, I've talked to some staff members in the House and actually some members who are incredibly frustrated with the fact that the Senate, they perceive the Senate as bullying them. And for a while, they were talking about this, what was called a ping pong procedure. So what would happen is the House would actually pass an identical version of the bill the Senate passed so that you wouldn't even have to go to conference. But basically, that was nixed within the caucus. They are going to go to conference. And again, it's going to be a little bit of a game of chicken. I mean, the question is, how much can Nancy Pelosi extract in those negotiations to kind of bend but not break what's on the table? Because it is going to be very difficult when it comes out of conference for Nelson then to turn around and to filibuster.
You think the liberals in the House will, in the end, be forced to accept no public option? They've made some very strong statements.
You know, it's a sort of a hard thing to game out. I mean, the way this whole thing has gone has been at once, you know, from day to day it's surprising, but in the long term has looked basically like a lot of what the compromise hashed out in kind of health care policy wonk circles was about 3 or 4 years ago. So, I wouldn't want to put a number on it, but I do think that people should not underestimate Nancy Pelosi, who has proven herself to be a very effective and shrewd political operator.
One of the best whips the House has seen in recent memory. All right, so that's the healthcare is Congress's deal right now. Let's go over to the White House's deal right now, which is Guantanamo Bay and trying to find a way to get Gitmo closed, which the president said months ago that was his stated policy. So 12 detainees from Guantanamo Bay were repatriated over the weekend, right? Half were sent to Yemen and the rest to Afghanistan and the Somalia region. Can we expect more of this to happen before, I guess, the rest of the Guantanamo detainees will be sent to Illinois for trial, or some of them for trial?
Yeah, so it looks like, I mean, we know that they've sort of accelerated negotiations. They've been working extremely hard to transfer as many of these detainees as they can. I mean, we even have several Chinese Uyghurs swimming around the Caribbean right now because of it.
Yeah.
I think that it's going to be very hard for them to make the one-year deadline that they sort of announced when the president took office. But things now at least are moving in a vector that you can see them moving towards the outcome that they want to achieve.
All right, let me turn to Jill McGivering from our partner, the BBC, and we want to talk about Pakistan. Jill, U.S. officials have been traveling back and forth to Pakistan, but it doesn't appear that we're still getting much cooperation from the Pakistanis on what the White House and the military want. I think one of the key questions here is, can we get the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI, on our side as we try to fight al-Qaeda and Taliban militias in the mountainous regions of Pakistan? Is am I right? Is that what's on the agenda?
Absolutely. I think there are completely different perceptions at the moment on the two sides. And you're right. It seems to be growing frustration amongst U.S. officials who are taking their message to Islamabad, trying to get across to Pakistani officials. Look, it's all very well us trying to do a surge to try to do what we can in Afghanistan, but it's not going to be very effective. The whole thing's going to be undermined if the people that we're after just cross the border and hide out and wait there in Pakistan in the tribal areas. We need your cooperation to chase them on that side. But Pakistan sees it very differently. They see this as not really their problem. They're very anxious about what's happening in Afghanistan. They feel problems are being stirred up that are going to cause long-term insecurity within Pakistan. But they're also very cautious about alienating those powerful clans along the border. Traditionally, they've often made deals with them. They've been an important buffer against those coming in from Afghanistan. And as India's influence in Afghanistan increases, some of those in Pakistan are saying, hang on there, we're going to need allies. We don't want to alienate them. We don't want to be seen to be too close to the United States.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because for their own domestic political purposes, which are important, the Pakistani government still seems to think that appearing to strongly resist the United States and our policies is better for them domestically.
Absolutely. And it does have, fair enough, I mean, in the sense that President Zardari is in a very difficult position. If you chat to most people in Pakistan, the message I hear from them is, we don't really trust the Americans. We think that they're fair weather friends. They're here just for a while. They're pursuing their own interests. They're drawing us into this growing conflict. Then they're going to pull out and go home, and we're going to be left with it. So they're very anxious about the impact, the long-term problems that are going to be set up for Pakistan to deal with. And certainly some people are saying, look, we want a government in Islamabad that sticks up for Pakistan's interests, and sometimes that means saying no to the Americans.
All right.
So that puts them in a really tough position.
It does. Jill McGivering from our partner, the BBC, thanks for bringing us up to speed as U.S. officials try to work on Pakistan and getting the government and the intelligence services more on our side. Chris Hayes from The Nation, let me come back to you. Christmas time is coming up. The Obamas are vacationing where else? In Hawaii, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think if you were Barack Obama, you'd want to get about as far away from Washington as you could as
and
well.
And take the press corps with you as you go.
That's exactly right.
All right, the president is heading to the beach with his family. Chris Hayes, Washington editor for The Nation, and Jill McGivering from our partner, the BBC, joining us for The Agenda. Thanks to you both. Coming up, we talk about family life every Monday, and as the family gathers for the holidays, how do you build religious bridges? How to smooth things over with your overly religious or underly religious relatives? That's coming up in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. That is people in Iran chanting pro-opposition slogans, fighting against the government. More turmoil news out of Iran. Over the weekend, one of the Islamic Republic's founding leaders passed away in his sleep. The revered Ayatollah was a very fierce critic of the nation's government. And the country's opposition yesterday took to the streets in mourning. Joining us now is Robert Wirth, the New York Times Beirut bureau chief. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
What makes this Ayatollah such an important figure that his death sparks street riots?
Well, he's the most senior cleric in Iran. So when he makes criticisms of the regime, they have a kind of legitimacy that other people lack. He came out very, very strongly, especially in the past few months since the election. And he said, the Islamic Republic is neither Islamic nor a republic. He basically said that Khamenei, the supreme leader, had lost his legitimacy. He said all kinds of things that have been said by other people, and other people get thrown in jail for it. But the regime can't. So the Iranian government cannot throw Montazeri in jail just because of his status.
Well, there was such strong feeling for him that there would have been public mourning in any case. But I assume that combined with the current state of affairs in Iran, that's what has turned this into a violent protest.
Yeah, absolutely. The opposition is looking for any excuses to come out into the streets and show their strength and protest. They've done that repeatedly in the past two or three months for national holidays and things like that. So this was obviously going to bring people out. There were some attempts yesterday to sort of limit that. And it's hard to tell exactly right now because the Internet has been very, very slow. That often happens with big events like this. It seems like the government tries to limit access. But there seemed to be a huge turnout of people, including a lot of people waving green banners, which is the color of the opposition, particularly of Mir Hossein Mousavi, who was there apparently, according to the Iranian one of the news agencies. Mousavi attended the funeral.
Mousavi was the opposition candidate who lost to Ahmadinejad over the summer. This isn't the only crisis facing the government in Iran right now, though. On Saturday, some military prosecutors came out with allegations that prison guards had actually tortured to death at least three, possibly more, student protesters back in July. And this obviously is causing uproar as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been less visible uproar over that. I think on its face, it's a vindication for what some of the opposition leaders have been saying. You know, they've long said that a lot of people were killed in these protests, and in particular, people were beaten to death in prison, which became a really contentious issue because people were there were allegations that people were tortured. There were even allegations people were raped in prison, which is an especially sensitive thing.
And top leaders had been denying that.
That's right. That's right. The police, the prosecutors, they had acknowledged that some torture took place, and even Ayatollah Khamenei had come out and had personally ordered the closing of a really notorious detention center. So the government had made clear that they knew that the torture had gone on, but they had not admitted that people actually died from that torture. So when this military court came out on Saturday and said this did happen, at least three people were beaten to death, that was an important marker.
Robert Wirth is the New York Times Beirut bureau chief. Thank you. Reportedly, hundreds of thousands of people on the streets in Iran. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick. He's filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, How do you celebrate a religious holiday with your family when your family does not agree on issues of faith? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Overseas Major General Anthony Cucullo, the U.S. Army general in northern Iraq, has told his soldiers if they get pregnant or cause a pregnancy while on duty, they will face a court-martial. Major Cucullo defended his decision while he spoke earlier to our partner at the BBC.
My message to the females, think before you do something because I need you. And for the males, it's if you take one of my soldiers out of the fight, well, there are consequences for that too.
The pregnancy ban also includes married soldiers who are serving in a combat zone together. Back in the States, the Senate appears to be on track to pass its health care overhaul before Christmas. The bill passed a key test vote early this morning. It passed by the 60-40 margin needed to overcome a threatened Republican filibuster. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was not impressed by the timing of the vote.
But make no mistake, if the people who wrote this bill were proud of it, they wouldn't be forcing this vote in the dead of night.
That's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Staying with health news now, Maine could become the first state to insist that cell phones carry health warnings. A Maine legislator wants cell phones to be clearly labeled that using one may cause brain cancer. The claim is disputed by some industry leaders and scientists. The Associated Press has released its annual poll of U.S. editors and news directors' top stories of the year. The economy was issue number one, followed closely by the inauguration of President Barack Obama. Third was the battle in Congress over health care, followed by the U.S. auto industry's troubles. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually there we are, all in what we are is still family.
So you think negotiating health care reform is a difficult thing? I would say that for some families who have maybe 20 people gathering for Christmas dinner, that's kind of a difficult negotiation sometimes. Also,
and getting 60% support from anyone in your family is probably just as
exactly.
Hard.
I think you're not likely to get any kind of 60 votes there. How do you respectfully take on religious differences when you gather for the holidays, especially when your kid is perhaps more religious than you are? We're joined now by Lori Dinnerstein-Kurz, who can talk about this from her own personal point of view. And of course, Lisa Belkin, our takeaway contributor. She writes the family and parenting blog Motherload for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Laura, you're the grandmother of 10 children. So explain how this religious divide plays out in your family.
Well, there are 7 who come from a family that's very observant, and there are 3 grandchildren who are from a family that are not particularly observant. And it's keeping the balance that's so important.
So Lisa Belkin, you know, I would imagine that Lori's actually kind of simplified. She only has 2 major differences in her family. Sometimes the families together, they can encompass 3, 4, maybe even 5 different religious views all sitting at one dinner table.
Yeah, and then you add what everyone can and can't eat and are not allergic to, and you really are trying to adapt. Yeah, we have changed in terms of how religious we are in the country. There are interesting trends. Protestants, people who identify as Protestants, is down by half since 1950. It's now about 25%, was about 50% back in 1950. But at the same time, the number of us who identify as evangelical Christians has jumped from about 10% to the same 25%. So people are getting more religious and less religious at the same time. Conservative Jews, which is what's going on in Lori's family, is down about 15% overall in the country. And yet at the same time, the number of Orthodox Jews is up by about 10%. So we're shifting in odd ways, and that always plays out. You know, major trends always play out at dining room tables.
So, Lori, you raised your kids in kind of the conservative, that's the more middle-of-the-road area.
Yeah, conservadox, yeah.
And then your daughter went towards Orthodox Judaism.
She embraced being very observant, and my son went the other direction.
He went towards more liberal
reform,
views.
Reform, yeah.
So
reform.
You have 3 versions of the same, luckily, this at least the same
well,
faith.
Well, then we have 4, because then there's me, and I'm in the middle.
Okay, so how specifically does this work? I mean, what problems arise at your dinner table?
Well, it's not so much at the dinner table, because at the dinner table means it's at my house, which means I'm in control, and I know exactly what to serve and how to serve it to whom. So I sort of have erased that problem by having it all gatherings at my house.
So you make all food conform to Orthodox, and then everyone else can just eat that, or do you cook a bunch of different versions of everything?
Well, interestingly enough, I keep my house to the kosher level of my daughter and her family, and so anyone who comes to my house can eat, no matter who they are.
And how do the grandchildren react?
They're fine, because they understand this is. They all come to grandma's house. They're not saying no to me. So they come here, and whatever I provide, they partake.
So, Laura, your solution to this problem then is really one of, for lack of a better term, vertical control. You cook the way you cook. It comes from mom or from grandma, and that's the way it is.
Yeah. So I just think that I, as the grandparent and the parent to those my grown children, it's my obligation to be the adult, be the one who must be flexible and open. It would be nice if the siblings could be flexible and open, and hopefully they are, but nonetheless, I have to be if I want to keep the family intact. And so I figured out a way that holidays, whatnot, if I'm at my home, I have control and everybody's happy.
Okay, but Lisa, again, Lori, you know, as much as that can be a difficulty, she can solve that by just going towards the more orthodox of the faith. They're still talking about different versions of one faith. And in many families, we're talking about somewhere you're going to have a Catholic next to an atheist, next to a Muslim, next to a Buddhist.
Yes, and that's, Lori actually founded the organization for that, which is PORC, interestingly, Lori, Parents of Religious Kids. And it's, parents want their kids to grow up the way they are. And anything that our kids do other than that, even if we, you know, will say, oh, anything you want, sweetheart, follow your bliss, we want you to find yourself, we're uncomfortable when our children are something we're not, because somehow that feels like judgment, if you will. And when that plays out, if you don't ever get to the root of it, actually the time not to do it is the holidays. It should be done at any time other than the holidays to address this directly. But it has to be addressed. It has to be addressed at its core, which is you have made a different choice than I did, and that feels uncomfortable to me.
So it sounds to me, Lisa, like your takeaway here is number one rule, if you had to give only one, deal with this before everyone sits down for dinner.
Yes, and it's the takeaway we have at all our family conversations here on Mondays, isn't it? Is talk to each other.
And Lori, is that pretty much your number one rule?
Well, talking to each other in our situation wouldn't help a lot, because neither one of those two can bend or be flexible. So there's no talking. Well, there's no way, because the very observant can't be flexible and the less observant won't be, because the others aren't. So it becomes in my hands. So hopefully if I cover all my bases at the end of the day, they can all leave with smiles, and I smile too, because it's my role to smooth it all out. I know what each expects, and if I make sure that happens, then it's okay.
It's all okay if Lori Dinnerston-Kurz is you're hosting your dinner, grandmother of 10 children, joining us from her home in New Jersey. And Lisa Belkin writes the family and parenting blog Motherload for our partner, The New York Times. So how do you deal with religious differences within your family? Tell us your story.
I'm a Muslim, and my family does not practice Islam. They practice Christianity. So on Thanksgiving, we get two turkeys, one regular turkey and one halal turkey. And that's how we handle Thanksgiving.
You can call us like she did at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Speaking of the holidays, the season might be in full effect, but maybe not on your street. How has the economy affected the holiday season on your block?
Good morning, Troy, calling from North Dakota. I haven't paid any attention to changes in decorating for the holidays, but I do know from my experiences in church leadership that church tithes and offerings always increase in hard times, and I think that's a wonderful phenomena to ponder.
So donations up at the church, maybe fewer lights or fewer Santas on your block. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And please don't forget to tune in this Christmas Day. We're going to bring you a very special edition of the show, an extremely cool edition of the show. It's Christmas from 1941. We're dipping into the sound archives to hear how Americans were feeling just weeks after Pearl Harbor. We were suddenly a nation at war. It was a tough time economically as well. We're going to hear about sports, the movies, the music from that year. That was when Bogey debuted in the Maltese Falcon
right.
In 1941. Lots going on. Tune in Friday. It really is a cool edition of the show on Christmas Day. Christmas 1941 on The Takeaway. Tune in on Friday. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway. The climate talks are over in Copenhagen.
Going forward, We're going to have to build on the momentum that we established in Copenhagen to ensure that international action to significantly reduce emissions is sustained and sufficient over time.
Despite what the president says, no big agreements were reached, and that has climate activists screaming. Planes jetted home from Denmark to points all over the world. The talks ended with some handshakes, but what do we really have to look forward to? Meaningful reductions in carbon emissions or rising oceans? And more talks. Talking's a good thing, but so is action. We're cutting through the chatter. There's a policy in there somewhere. We'll find it. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 21st, the shortest day of the year. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry.
Does that mean we get to end the show early? Or?
Right now, we're done.
There's too much news to end early. Let's get right to it. Senate Democrats are one ginormous step closer to passing a health care bill by Christmas. At about 1 in the morning, the bill passed the first of three procedural votes by a 60-40 margin, the exact number that they need to overcome a Republican filibuster. As it stands now, the bill would extend coverage to more than 30 million Americans while banning insurance company practices such as denial of benefits on the basis of pre-existing medical conditions. There'll be two more procedural votes before the Senate votes on the bill itself on Christmas Eve. And we're learning more this morning about what happened behind closed doors at the climate talks in Copenhagen last week. Ed Miliband, Britain's climate change secretary, is accusing China of hijacking the summit by blocking a legally binding treaty. Miliband says it was China who vetoed attempts to give legal force to greenhouse gas reductions.
For a recap now on the climate talks, we're joined by David Biello. He's associate editor of Environment and Energy at Scientific American, and he's a friend of The Takeaway, of course. Good morning, David. Copenhagen is over now, so everyone's gone home, and a lot of the reporting says there was little progress. But the president says important progress was made. What are we supposed to believe here? Is the president trying to spin this, or was there anything important done?
I think it's more significant than maybe some folks think. After all, 30 countries representing 90% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions have, for the first time, said they're going to do something about it.
They've said they're going to do something about it, but they're not bound.
They're not bound.
All right, David Biello, stay with us because we'll talk more about the difference between being bound and being not bound and what that actually means in terms of the amount of carbon that we're emitting into the air. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
The U.S. transferred a dozen suspected terrorists out of Guantanamo Bay over the weekend. They were sent to Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia, the Justice Department says. That leaves 198 detainees at the Cuban facility. Washington, D.C. police looking into reports that a plainclothes officer pulled a gun during a mass snowball fight on a city street. A video posted on YouTube shows the detective waving and pointing a gun as he walks toward a group that had hit his car with snow.
Yeah, that made some headlines in Washington yesterday. If you're heading to the airport today, expect minimal delays. Officials at airports along the East Coast say things are almost back to normal after a winter storm canceled thousands of flights over the weekend. But if the snow was not enough to keep James Cameron's Avatar from hitting the top spot at the box office, the science fiction epic took in $79 million domestically and another $160 million worldwide. Coming in at number two was The Princess and the Frog, followed by Blindside. Today is the busiest day of the year at UPS. The world's largest shipper expects to deliver about 22 million packages. Asian stocks were mixed. European indices are up today. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,328. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,211.
Coming up, one part holiday music, one part weird.
Bell, jingle, rock, rock, bell. Bell, rock, jingle, rock, bell, rock, bell.
We're going to bring you some non-traditional holiday songs that may not deserve to become classics, and some that are actually really great. That's coming up later this hour. And the holiday season is in full swing, but what are you seeing on your street? How has the economy affected the holiday season on your block? More lights? Less lights? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, talks in Copenhagen are over. Is there anything to take away? We're wondering, and we'll talk about it in a minute.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John Hockenberry. The Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen wrapped up Saturday with positive reviews from at least one participant.
The world's major economies have come together to accept their responsibility to take action to confront the threat of climate change. After extremely difficult and complex negotiations, This important breakthrough lays the foundation for international action in the years to come.
Now, he would say that, of course, because the President of the United States has some political capital invested in the Copenhagen conference and the issues of climate change. But the real question is, how much carbon are we going to emit? And did the conference make any progress towards lowering the amount of carbon we're going to put into the air? Well, we're joined again by David Biello. He's the Associate Editor of Environment and Energy at Scientific American. He just returned from Copenhagen this weekend. And also Kathleen McGinty, Chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality during the Clinton-Gore administration. David, I want to start with you. Who are the winners and losers coming out of this conference?
Well, I think there's really only one partial winner, and that's President Obama. He, as you said, invested some political capital in this. And while he didn't get a perfect deal, he did get something to bring back home and say, you know, I succeeded. The losers are, well, everybody from President Obama and the rest of the world. Nobody got exactly what they wanted. Small island states still face rising sea levels. African countries don't get the development aid they're looking for. The U.S. and EU don't get the emissions cuts they're looking for. And China and India, for the first time, have to take on the burden of reducing their emissions.
Kathleen, what about you? Winners and losers, what do you think?
No, I guess I slightly disagree. I think that, unfortunately, the whole process in Copenhagen was a failure and a setback for both the United States and for the planet. For the planet, because instead of having a binding treaty in 2009, which up until a month ago was the objective, we're now looking at not even considering that until 2015. And for the United States, it shouldn't be that the President of the United States is put in a position to walk into a situation that has enabled itself to become so fractious, and for him to have to extend himself the way he did, really for a document that is not very much substantively.
That can at best, as David Biello describes it, be described as something. The president got something. So what does this now mean for, you say, the next round of talks, Kathleen, not until 2015, so we just keep polluting carbon for the next 5 years? Is that the game plan?
Well, look, the upshot was that everyone pledged to do what they've been doing, essentially. China, India, to their credit, have been taking very meaningful actions. In fact, they have on the books stronger laws and regulations for renewable energy as a country than we have at the national level today. They have stronger requirements for fuel efficiency, for example. So they've pledged, well, we'll keep it up and we'll send you a letter once a year telling you what we've been doing. And we said we would do what we've been doing, which is we'll continue to work towards putting those same kinds of things in place in the United States. So at best, I think we've got a status quo here. But in terms of the international scene, we have a setback from where we were supposed to have a binding accord this year to one where the date is past the next set of major elections in the United States to 2015. And that, to me, is tremendous momentum loss in terms of a planetary or a global agreement.
I agree with that, but I think the blame for that rests squarely on about 100 Americans, namely the U.S. Senate. The president was going into this situation without a lot of backing, let's say, from the political establishment, and that's why he found himself having to burst into meetings between, you know, Brazil, India, and China and really extend himself to get something.
David Biello, an editor with Scientific American. Was it money that ended up sinking the ability to get a deal? What was it? What was the sticking point that kept us from getting anything out of Copenhagen?
Well, there were a number of sticking points, one of which is, of course, economic. The developed countries of the world don't necessarily want to sacrifice any economic growth, particularly in a time of economic crisis, to combating climate change, and that is doubly true for developing world, where their number one focus is getting the millions in their countries still in poverty out of poverty. But there were some other issues, such as verification. Kathleen mentioned the letter that China and India are going to send us once a year. The U.S. and others were pushing very hard for some form of independent verification that actual emission cuts were being made. That's because, at least on the basis of my own travels in China, oftentimes, let's say, an emissions control device, will be turned on when the journalists and public officials are there and then turned off again as soon as we leave.
Okay, so carbon emissions, sort of like a nuclear facility maybe outside of Pyongyang when you turn the webcams off when the inspectors get there.
Right.
Kathleen, we want to be able to verify carbon emissions in China and India, that they do what they say they're going to do. They probably want to know the same thing from us. The Senate isn't getting anywhere substantial yet on climate change. And if they don't get there, Obama, the president, says the EPA will regulate for them. Are we likely to see some carbon regulations, do you think, in the first term of Barack Obama?
Well, let's look at that. And I think David made an important point about the 100 Americans in the Senate. But in fairness to the Senate, they are carrying out what has been the president's top priority, which is health care. Now, it could be argued that maybe two pieces of legislation could have been identified as a priority by the White House to move through at the same time. But the singular focus has been on health care, and we haven't seen very much progress in the Senate on climate. I'm reminded of Teddy Roosevelt saying, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. We didn't have a stick to carry into Copenhagen because we don't have legislation. And I think that should have counseled us to speak a little more softly.
A little more softly. Well, David Biello, the president is trying to hold that stick over the Senate. You guys regulate, or the Environmental Protection Agency will. Do you think we're going to see carbon regulations before the end of his term?
Well, it really all depends on health care. If health care implodes, it looks like climate will kind of go down with it. But as you know, Ben Nelson signed on just a day or so ago, so perhaps health care will pass. And then with that victory under his belt, Obama has said he will turn to climate change.
Well, we'll see if that actually happens and what happens with Democratic Senator Ben Nelson, who's got interest in climate change for his corn growers in Nebraska. David Biello, Associate Editor of Environment and Energy at Scientific American. Kathleen McGinty is Chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality during the Clinton-Gore administration. Thank you both for joining us. And now here's a look at some of the headlines we're following.
Early this morning, the health care reform bill got a step closer to getting passed in the Senate by a 60-40 margin. One of the bill's critics, as we said, Senator Ben Nelson, defended his change of heart to vote for the bill. In a statement this morning, the Nebraska Democrat says, quote, change is never easy, but he understood how many people need help to pay for health care. Nelson's support was crucial. He provided the 60th vote that Democrats needed to stop a Republican filibuster. Actress Brittany Murphy has died after collapsing at her Los Angeles home yesterday morning. Murphy became well known from appearing in movies like 8 Mile, Just Married, and Clueless. Police are investigating the death of the 32-year-old actress, although officials say they believe at this stage she died of natural causes. The snowstorm that hit the Northeast is over, but it's left thousands without power. Nearly 200,000 in North Carolina, West Virginia, and Virginia don't have power because of the snowstorm.
Washington, D.C. police are investigating a police detective after internet videos showed him waving his gun during a mass snowball fight on a city street. Police say they were looking into reports that the plainclothes officer pulled a gun after he and his personal car were hit with snowballs. At the box office, not even bad weather in the Northeast could stop the movie Avatar from storming into the number one spot.
They've sent us a message that they can take whatever they want. But we will send them a message that this is our land.
Epic. James Cameron's science fiction film took in $73 million domestically and over $159 million overseas. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, doctors might not make house calls anymore, but they can still keep up on you while you're in your home. That's through a web browser, more on a web service to have doctors diagnose you while you're at home. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week, and we're joined again by Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor. Good morning to both of you. So, Louise, this is a medical story about doctors who are not doing house calls anymore, but there's a new online program from the United Health Group, and it's going to give you the option of seeing the doctor from your home. From your couch, if you have a laptop, maybe. That's $45 a pop to virtually have a doctor's visit. Explain this to me.
Well, it's called Now Clinic, so you can see your doctor now. And you're right, it's only $45. It's for people with insurance or even without insurance.
Same price.
I think it's the same price for both. That's what they say on their site. And So the goal here is to reduce the cost of healthcare. And, you know, we're looking at this big healthcare overhaul. And the question is, would you rather have the longer lines in the waiting rooms or find some other more creative ways to help people with routine care? And it's kind of one of the trade-offs we're going to have to see in a lot of businesses in the next year. This country has become overextended. We don't have the kind of easy credit we had in yesteryear. So a lot of business questions are going to have to address what sort of trade-offs do we make. And this is one of them, you know?
The medical question is, can you do healthcare without actually examining your patient?
Well, that's the question. And actually, this has already started in a few states. It's going nationwide. This Now Clinic's going nationwide in January, but it's already started in Hawaii and Texas. And those are interesting examples because in Texas, they passed a law that said, okay, you can see your doctor on the computer, but you've got to meet them first and establish a relationship. Mm. But in Hawaii, they said, no relationship needed, just log online. And that's a central question. You know, is it the same kind of healthcare or not if it's on the computer?
Okay, well, you know, the thing for me is at least I don't have to, you know, feel the cold press of that stethoscope that the doctor has had sitting in the refrigerator for the past 5 minutes before he puts it on my
chest.
But
that's the thing that tells the doctor if you have an irregular heart rhythm, which he
the
can't tell over the internet.
The freezing cold stethoscope?
Yes. As cold as it is, it will tell you if you have a bad heart.
But keep watching this because next year it's going to be the theme in all parts of the economy, tough trade-offs, looking for shortcuts, looking for more efficiency.
Right. Well, we'll see what other things it ends up affecting. I mean, I'm kind of scared to see what other businesses are going straight to online.
To get commoditized. All right. Thanks, Louise Story. Next, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the IAM Takeaway Sports Contributor. Ibrahim, I'll set the scene for you. I was in the train station yesterday evening in the mayhem at Washington, D.C.'s Union Station waiting for the train with thousands of other people. All of a sudden, a train pulled in and I saw one big dude in a suit, then another big dude in a suit, then a whole long line of about 40 or 50 really big guys in suits walking through the train station in Washington, D.C. Who do you think that was?
So this Monday night, tonight, the New York Giants are going to be playing against the Washington Redskins.
Well, that was my question. It was the New York Giants
exactly.
Walking. Thank you very much.
And so this is a game, and we had spoke about this a little bit earlier, but in the NFC, there's 9 teams that are eliminated from the playoffs. There's only one team that has a chance to break in to that six-team group, and that is the New York Giants. So they have to run the table for the rest of their games to do that, and they have to win tonight.
Well, lucky for them, they're playing the Redskins because the chance of winning is very high.
However, the Redskins and the NFC East is one of the most brutal conferences, and the Redskins have been playing spoiler, just like Carolina Panthers, who beat the Minnesota Vikings last night, playing the spoiler. So you'll see a lot of these teams in the bottom parts of the record, they're going to be playing the spoilers, and that's exactly what the Redskins want to do tonight.
Well, as bad as they are this year, and they are terrible, the Washington Redskins, they did take out the Broncos when they were 6-0.
They did take out the Broncos. They have a great defense. They have a lot of key pieces to a puzzle. So I wouldn't say that they're that bad. And I would say to Redskins fans that you have the basic nucleus of a really good team. They just haven't been well coached.
You're a Pollyanna. I mean, if you were in Washington, D.C. and you said that, people would laugh you towards
They have a difficult owner, and that's also a challenge that they have.
Yeah, okay. So the Giants really feel like they need to win this game. Well, they don't feel like they do need
to win
this game.
They need to win, correct.
All right, tell me about Kobe Bryant.
So Kobe Bryant has had a broken finger. And in the time that he's had this broken finger, and it's been 5 games in a row, he's averaged 30.8 points per game. This is the important thing about Kobe Bryant. He's an returning NBA champion, so the Lakers won last year. But over the year, he worked out with Hakeem Olajuwon to do what? To change his game. And what he did is that he added in a post game. And a lot of players, they come back, he has a great jump shot. He used to just go in and dunk on people, just use his speed. But now he's got this mid-range game that's very similar to another great NBA star, Michael Jordan. As he got to the waning part of his career, Michael Jordan improved his game by getting an amazing post game, and he transformed his game. So look at that when you're watching basketball, Kobe Bryant.
Which finger was it?
I think it's index his right
finger.
Index.
Right index. Finger.
Right
exactly.
Index. All right, okay. Kobe Bryant, broken finger, making him a better player. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. Thanks, man.
Good morning.
And our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. We just wrapped up our series last week on life in fine print, how you avoid the devils in the details.
How about electronic fine print? DirecTV doesn't even put the fine print on the contract you sign. It's buried on their websites. That way, it's much more malleable.
At 8778MyTake, Joe in Detroit says fine print doesn't have to be all that bad.
Use the fine print against them. Just take advantage of every perk that they give you and always pay your bills on time, and you can get a lot more out of them.
We also got an email from someone calling themselves Vector GES. who says that we have an underutilized weapon in our arsenal. He writes, when reacting to fine print, be sure to give feedback to the lender. If you're unhappy about credit card rates, cancel the card and tell the insurer why you're doing it. If the fine printers don't get the feedback, they assume no one cares. Let them know who you are.
Beyond the fine print, we also talked about The Waiting Room, a documentary film and social media project that highlights the views of patients waiting inside the Highland Hospital in Oakland, California. And Dina emails us, I'd like someone to ask these people, are people at home unemployed and worried about health insurance? Have you contacted your state senator and representatives? I'm really sad to keep hearing about all these people who are worried and need health care, or people like me with jobs and insurance, though I know I could lose my job. Do other people other than just me write and call your senators and let them know we do not support their continued fighting over health care reform? Airing these stories on the radio is not doing anything to make a change one way or the other. Thanks for that email, Dina. And let's turn it over to you, the listeners. You've heard us talking about health care. Tell us, how do you turn your views into action? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, how does the military get some translators and intel staff into the services? We're going to talk about a new recruiting program that's set to expire soon.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the new recruiting strategy in the military. They'll offer you a few years in the military, and in exchange, they'll do your paperwork to get you citizenship. We're going to talk about that more in a few moments, but first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. Senate Democrats are one step closer to passing a bill that would overhaul health care. The first vote came in the early morning hours.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 40.
And it clears the first of three major procedural hurdles before the full vote on the bill itself, now scheduled for Christmas Eve. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid convinced two holdouts, Independent Joe Lieberman and Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson, to move health care reform forward. Nelson is already feeling some heat this morning, though, from abortion rights groups. He's issued a statement defending his vote, saying too many people are struggling to pay for their health care, so doing nothing was not an option. Heading overseas. Tens of thousands of mourners turned a funeral procession for Iranian Ayatollah Montazeri into an anti-government protest in the city of Qom. Foreign journalists have been barred, but there are reports of clashes between Iranian security forces and opposition supporters. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says military force would have only limited effect in stopping Iran from developing nuclear weapons, but it must remain an option. Admiral Mike Mullen told his staff this morning he believes political means are the best way to handle Iran at this moment.
Earlier this morning,
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Fueling tower separates. Booster ignition. Liftoff.
A rocket carrying an American, a Russian, and a Japanese crew took off for the International Space Station. A NASA webcast showed the crew giving the thumbs up as the rocket headed skyward. And also rocketing skyward, shares of Dutch luxury car maker Spyker. The company is trying to rekindle talks with General Motors by making a new bid to buy the Saab brand. And the National Football League is calling an audible when it comes to how it treats concussions. According to new rules announced yesterday, players must now be cleared by brain injury experts unaffiliated with the team, and they can't return to the game in which they've been shown to show any signs of concussion. Turning to the markets now, the Dow is up about 52, the S&P is up 6, and the NASDAQ is up about 14 in early trading. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The Department of Defense has been on a recruiting blitz this year, you could say. They're making extra efforts to reach immigrants, particularly immigrants who can put their language skills to use for the military. And in return, these new recruits get a fast track to citizenship. The Army will fill out all their paperwork. In the process, the military boosts its diversity, so it sounds kind of like a win-win situation. Staff Sergeant Corey Grant is a recruiting officer at the Army Recruiting Battalion in New York City, where the program started earlier this year. Here he is on the phone with a potential applicant who has Farsi language skills.
It's not a matter of you not being qualified. You just have to have the Dari dialect is what they need. Are you worried about not passing the Dari dialect? Yes, you can change your job. Yes, you can.
And he's in the studio with us. Welcome, Staff Sergeant Grant. So you're looking for recruits that have experience in one of over 35 different languages. Is that right?
Yes. Primarily, It's the ones that are very big. It's just the influence. India, Persian, Chinese, Korean. But that number is fine. It's just a matter of not everybody's going to come over here and join. You know, you're going to have populations. So the Indian is very big. So you're going to have a lot of people who speak Hindi, Punjabi.
I was about to say, which Indian Urdu, are you talking about?
You know, Urdu, Tamil, and those are the ones that are just flooding it right now.
You're looking for Arabic speakers as well?
Yes, yes.
And you're also offered this fast track to citizenship. How does that work?
Pretty much, you have to meet the qualifications just to be even eligible for the MAVNI. But pretty much what happens is we do everything in the office. Paperwork, the N-400, which is the citizenship.
You take care of all their paperwork for them?
Paperwork when they ship off, when they go out to basic training, they turn in their paperwork. They have, I want to say, little kiosks that handle them, process their paperwork. In about 6 to 10 months, they do have the citizenship.
Well, what you're referring to in the MAVNI program is the Military Accessions to Vital to National Interest program. It's going to end on December 31st. And let's talk now to somebody who's actually come into the military under this program, Srinivasi Dandu. Good morning.
Good morning.
You enlisted through this recruitment program, and you're actually shipping out on January 6th, right?
Yes.
Can you tell me, why did you decide to enlist in the Army?
Actually, I was searching for a job from the past like few months, and one of my cousins just suggested me that they are quitting in the Army. When I heard about the Army, I just really got interested because from past 10-15 years I was really interested. And one more thing, I need a job, and so I just contacted Sergeant Grant, and I started. And the really interesting thing in my joining the Army was the job I was offered. It was into the automotive side, and I was really interested in working automotive side from my childhood, and I never got an opportunity to work in automotive, and I don't really have a proper degree to work in that. But as the Army trains me in that and gives me a job, so I just got into it.
What is your language specialty?
Urdu.
Okay, and how did your family react when you came home and said, hey, I'm going into the Army, Mom, Dad?
Yeah, actually my family supports me in everything I do, but the first reaction I got from my family and friends is, why U.S. Army, why not Indian Army?
So, Sergeant Grant, explain to me, how do these recruits end up fitting into the Army? Are all of them put into jobs like he is as an automotive trainee? Do some of them end up on the battlefield? What do they end up doing?
It's pretty much up to them. They can choose whatever job is available at the time. The only thing that they cannot choose is a job that requires a security clearance.
Right.
Because if they choose a job like that, if you go into a security clearance job, it starts when you join the Army. So since they don't have a citizenship yet, they cannot choose a job that requires a clearance.
So Staff Sergeant Corey Grant, Private Dandu, or soon-to-be Private Dandu, mm-hmm. said that his family supports him, but they said to him, why the U.S. Army, why not the Indian Army? And I wonder, as you approach young immigrants to this country, what do you offer them in terms of dealing with a skeptical family? Loyalty aside, I'm sure everyone's loyal, but the military's activities in Afghanistan or in Iraq might not be as popular with Afghani families or Iraqi families. What do you do for them if you want to get them in the military to take care of those concerns?
Well, I'm not sure about the Indian Army and other branches of service out there. I know in the United States Army, it's a wonderful institution, and being that here in America, it's so diverse. We have everybody in the Army anyway. Well before the MAVNI program even started, kicked off, we had individuals from Kenya, all over the world. So when they come here, when they seek guidance through the Army, I think that they know that they could be a part of something special, and they come to America for options anyway.
Well, let's ask Srinivasa Dandu. Srinivasa, did you have any conflicts with yourself over whether to join the American Army or the Indian?
As long as I'm dedicated to my work and I'm doing it working for a good cause, I don't matter where I'm working.
And it's good cause, whether it's American or Indian.
Yes, as long I think both countries are working for the same cause, and so I can work for any country. And
okay,
as long as I'm dedicated to work.
Srinivasa Dandu enlisted through this recruitment program. He's waiting to ship out on January 6th, and Staff Sergeant Corey Grant, recruiting officer at the Army Recruiting Battalion in New York City. Thanks to you both. Coming up, how do you celebrate the holidays if you're David Lynch?
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a body dead, wrapped in plastic.
How the cast of Twin Peaks and others are helping us remix holiday music, that's coming up later this hour with some surprising, some actually quite good holiday classics.
Some of them are quite good, and some of them veer into the downright weird.
That's right. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Chances are, if you've opened up your mail lately or watched TV in the past few days, which you probably have, you've stumbled upon an ad like this one.
If your car is under 10 years old, with less than 150,000 miles, you can save money. Lots of money with U.S. Fidelis. Call for more information and get a free quote in just 5 minutes.
And despite that fantastic delivery, what they're selling is extended warranties for car repairs, but it can be really hard to collect when your car gets to the mechanic. That's what we're finding out. The policies have attracted the attention of consumer watchdogs, and it looks like the boom times for the warranty sector might be ending. I think the word scam has been thrown around more than once. Reporter Scott Graff has been covering this for public radio station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Scott, straight up scam. What are you learning here?
We looked into this and we found the word scam quite often, Todd. We also found the word fraud involved with this industry a lot, and some pretty high-ranking folks in the world of law enforcement all across the country using words like that. I talked with several attorneys general, and they use those words on a regular basis when talking about the so-called vehicle service contract industry.
Vehicle service contract industry. You also ran into a fellow named Jimmy McGill. What's his story?
Yeah, Mr. McGill is in his late 70s. He's a Charlotte resident who a little over a year ago, 2 years ago, I guess, bought one of these from a company based out of St. Louis called U.S. Fidelis. It was for his wife's Chrysler sedan. It was about a 7-year-old, 8-year-old car at the time. It had 77,000 miles on it. They were promising bumper-to-bumper coverage. He bought it for about $1,370, and a little over a year after he bought it, the transmission went out, and he had a heck of a time, according to him, collecting any claim on his warranty. In fact, he found the going very tough. Here's Mr. McGill. Listen to this.
I would call one place, and they said, well, we sold you the insurance, but we're not responsible for it. We're just one of the brokers. And they would give me this other number to call when I would call this other number. In most cases, nobody would answer.
Well, finally, Mr. McGill got somebody on the phone and was able to find out that he needed to send every record on his car that he possibly could find to them so they could verify that he had been doing maintenance on the car. He got the help from his mechanic, Eddie Stokely.
They did not only ask for oil changes, they asked for his transmission service, tune-up records, how he's maintained his brakes, I mean, all the paperwork that he could find. And I could find in my stuff was sent to them, and they still declined him, saying that he didn't maintain his vehicle right.
So, Scott Graff for WFAE, this sounds like what they did to James McGill is buried him in paperwork and tried to prevent him from taking a claim. This is the kind of thing that the Better Business Bureau or maybe your state consumer protection commissioner likes to get a hold of.
Yep, we talked to both. We talked to the Better Business Bureau out of St. Louis, where many of these companies are located. In fact, the Missouri Attorney General calls it the Silicon Valley of this industry that he, again, says is full of fraud. The Better Business Bureau there has seen thousands of complaints from customers like Mr. McGill over the last several years, and attorneys generals all across the country have seen them as well, and many have filed suits. In fact, more than 40 right now are teaming up to investigate this industry to try and find out, you know, how it can be doing a better job for the customers that it's trying to serve.
Doing a better job, or should they be doing business at all? The car repair insurance industry. Scott Graff, reporter for public radio station WFAE, reporting on what's being called a scam in North Carolina. Thanks, Scott. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today, and here, of course, with Celeste Headlee. Coming up all this week, we're remixing holiday music because, let's be honest, who wants to listen to music that sounds like we're at sort of the worst mall ever? Well, we want to hear, do you want to hear Charlie Brown scratch like a DJ? Well, take a listen in a few minutes because that's exactly what we've got for you. Right now, here's a check on the leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The last Democratic senator to oppose the health care bill voted for it earlier today. Senator Ben Nelson defended his change of heart in a statement this morning. The Nebraska Democrat says, quote, change is never easy, but passing health reform was important for people who are struggling to pay for their health care. The vote passed this morning 60 to 40, avoiding a Republican filibuster. Staying with health news, Maine could become the first state to insist that cell phones carry health warnings. A Maine legislator wants cell phones to be clearly labeled that using one may cause brain cancer. The claim is disputed by some industry leaders and scientists.
Overseas, the discussions at the Global Climate Conference wrapped up on Saturday, but the British Prime Minister hasn't done talking. Prime Minister Gordon Brown says the Global Climate Conference in Copenhagen was hijacked. He complained today that the summit was held to ransom by a small group of countries. In Poland, police have recovered the infamous Nazi sign stolen from the former Auschwitz death camp. The sign reads in German, "Work sets you free." It was found cut into three pieces. Five men have been arrested for stealing it. And back in the States, UPS, the world's largest shipping carrier, is bracing itself for its busiest day. It's expected to deliver 22 million small packages today. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
All right, take it from the top again. Here we go. Yeah, do something right for a change, Charlie Brown.
That's Schroeder on the scratch and the piano. You hear that? This whole week we're paying tribute to holiday music with a special series we're calling Remixing the Holidays. Now, we're going to be talking to some fascinating and unexpected guests, ranging from Republican Senator Orrin Hatch to Twisted Sister. When was the last time you heard Orrin Hatch and Twisted Sister in the same sentence? And we're going to be talking to them about holidays and holiday music and what it means to them. Kicking off the series is John Solomon. For over 20 years, John's been hosting WPRB Princeton Radio's 24-hour Christmas Music Marathon. It begins every year on Christmas Eve at 6 p.m. That means on Friday night you have to tune in. It's Thursday night. It's so popular that hundreds of fans begin sending him suggestions for the broadcast as early as June each year. John, is that right?
Yeah. Wow. Orrin Hatch and Twisted Sister. I'm in fine company this week.
Make sure you're listening and hit the record button on your Adobe Audition, because you're going to want to probably remix that for the show. John Solomon, a Jewish kid like yourself, how'd you get wrangled into a Christmas gig that's lasted 20 years?
Well, I was 15 and I'd just been an intern at WPRB over the summer, and come December of 1988, there was this huge swath of time available on Christmas Eve, and I signed up for it and decided I would stay on until the next DJ showed up. And the next year I decided I wanted to try and do all 24 hours, and an unexpected tradition was born.
And you have enough people sending you Christmas cuts every year that you can easily fill 24 hours.
I think I could do a new show every year of a consistent quality level, not playing any of the records I had played the year previous.
We've got some great samplings of what you have, John. You kick off your show with the same song every year.
Absolutely.
And it's a pretty good one called Santa Claus by the Sonics. I'm going to guess around 1952. That's just a guess.
68,
oh,
I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's this amazing compilation that Etiquette Records put out, which has three holiday songs by the Sonics and two other bands from the Pacific Northwest, the Wailers and the Galaxies. And it's pretty consistent from beginning to end, just great garage rock songs that all happen to be holiday songs.
That happen to be holidays. And why make this your flagship song, your anthem?
It was just one of those things that I realized a couple years in a row I wanted to start on a real high point, and it was one of those things that I felt had the right tenor of the program to begin on this enthusiastic high note and hopefully ride that out for the next 23 hours and 56 minutes.
Right, garage rock and funk. You've sort of got it all covered here. This one is Boogaloo Santa by J.D. McDonald.
Hey boys and girls, I want you to listen to me. I want to tell you a story, couldn't hardly believe, but it happened to me on one Christmas Eve.
I could certainly be James Brown singing that, but it's J.D. McDonald. So this is another in the category of sort of real songs that talk about Christmas, not a novelty song.
The best new release that I've heard this holiday season is this Strut Records compilation called In the Christmas Groove, and it has all these amazing 70s soul and funk 45s that have been dusted off and collected on this anthology, and this song is on there.
Songs that stand on their own, but they happen to be about Christmas.
Exactly, that's an important part of the show to me, is having these great songs that just happen to be Christmas songs, or bands that you really like that you didn't know did these incredible holiday songs.
Okay, great songs that happen to be Christmas songs are fine, but there's a lot in sort of a weird category that probably don't stand on their own unless they're about Christmas and they're in the John Solomon annual Christmas show. Here's one by Culture Side. Listen to this one.
Santa Claus, he wants my lover. He's just a girl with a big white beard. But the reindeer's kind of weird.
Okay. Kind of weird.
Not Weird Al?
Well, Culture Side made a whole career out of taking pop songs from the 80s and just singing over them. And
in falsetto?
That's a perfect example of that. They also do Depressed Christmas, where they sing over White Christmas in similar fashion to what we're hearing right now.
Okay, so it's kind of creepy and terrible. And yet
it's not kind of creepy. It's exceptionally creepy.
Oh, we're all laughing. I guess that's the important part, right? All right, so that's Culture Side. P.S. Tail Esquire.
Try and get this one out of your head.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Bell, jingle, rock, rock, bell. Bell, rock, jingle, rock, bell, rock, bell. Rock, bell, jingle, rock, bell, bell, bell. Rock,
if
bell,
that song
rock,
is stuck
bell,
in my head, John Solomon, I will find you later, rock, and I will bell, probably rock, hurt you.
Celeste, this sounds like the kind of thing that your 10-year-old son Grant might want to memorize in
no,
the car.
No,
I think
no.
I'll send it to him. John, this is the kind of song that would have appealed to me when I was 10 or 11 for sure.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that.
So how many requests do you get for this is obviously the absolutely ludicrous and just kind of a straight up novelty song, quite apart from a good garage rock song.
Yeah, I don't know if novelty is completely fair to describe something like this, but I think there's a charm to it that I appreciate.
All right, we want to listen to Bit Shifter, his version of Let It Snow, computer-generated Christmas. Super Mario was kind of annoying when it was on a gigantic TV, and it's just as annoying now, I have to say.
No, I'm fascinated by people that take technology or use these different means of recording familiar Christmas music. I have people playing songs on old car horns, on rubber bands, on dot matrix printers, just people using these unique ways of reappropriating things that you might have heard originally in some form or another.
I was going to say, a couple of these are the kind of songs you can play at the end of the party to make everyone go home, right?
They head for the door as soon as they hear this.
Well, I think that's an important part of the show, is being able to take these things that are great because they're terrible and these things that are great because they're great and figure out a way to make them all work together.
Okay, we have time for just one more. We promised this, so we have to play it. The 12 Days of Christmas Now, performed by the cast of Twin Peaks in character.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a body, dead, wrapped in plastic.
On the second day of Christmas, my true love gave to me two secret diaries.
And a body, dead, wrapped in plastic.
Now, if you're old enough and you remember Twin Peaks, you're laughing. If you're too young to know what Twin Peaks is, Google David Lynch or ask Mom and Dad and you'll find out why it's hilarious. Check it out on YouTube. That song's from about 20 years ago.
Yeah, I guess that would be about 88 or 89. Can you imagine the pitch of getting all of the cast of Twin Peaks in to record this in some way, shape, or form?
No.
I bet they would have loved it. I bet they would have loved it.
Probably had somebody clutching their pile of logs, as I recall,
well,
right?
The log lady is in here somewhere.
Oh, she is in there. All right. Well, John Solomon, thanks for joining us. We want to go out with Merry Christmas by Silkworm.
Merry Christmas.
John Solomon joins us. He ends his 24-hour DJ extravaganza with this song, Silkworm. Every single year, you can hear it on WPRB Radio in Princeton, New Jersey. Tune in tomorrow now when our Remixing the Holiday series continues with Broadway star Brian Stokes Mitchell and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. So what's the song that keeps you sane during the holidays? Maybe it's traditional or maybe it's unusual, like this one.
Mrs. Claus, Mrs. Claus.
Supposed to be Mrs. Jones,
Claus,
I think. That's Mrs. Claus. LaGaspa from Detroit emails. Anything from Bob Rivers, more specifically this song, Me and Mrs. Claus, a parody of Billy and Paul's Me and Mrs. Jones. You can call your song and tell us, or better yet, just sing it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Don't forget to tune in this Friday for our special edition on Christmas Day. I'm Celeste Headley.
Thanks, Celeste. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
Just
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.